You're listening to a proud member of the Dice Tower Network, dedicated to bringing podcasters together for the greater good of gaming. It's sort of like Voltron, but with better lip syncing. Find out more at dicetowernetwork.com.
And welcome to another episode of the Family Gamers Podcast. This is episode 136.
Hey everybody, we are super excited to be coming at you this week. We've got a lot of great stuff to talk about. But first, I'd like to talk about our sponsor this week. The Family Gamers Podcast is sponsored by Breaking Games. They've created a bunch of awesome and amazing games, and one of them that we want to talk about right now is Order of Invention. We've been playing this game a fair bit.
Yeah, we played it a bit this week again, and it is a lot harder than it seems to figure out, you know, what came first, what came second, what came third, what came fourth, because there's some really tricky ones in there. Like, we all knew Velcro was old, but we didn't know that whack-a-mole is not.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it, it's a fairly simple, basic mechanical thing. We also found out that whack-a-mole was invented for Chuck E. Cheese.
That's an interesting factoid.
Yeah. And that's always one of those things that I've said a million times that I love when you play a game and you kind of learn interesting facts about history as you play them. And Order of Invention is a game that offers a little tidbit on every single invention once you flip those red cards over to blue.
Yeah, something about why or when it was invented.
Yep. So we're having a lot of fun with that game. We're going to keep playing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blast. You can check it out at breakinggames.com/products/order-of-invention. Thanks so much to Breaking Games for sponsoring the show. So like Anitra said before, this is episode 136 of the Family Gamers Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew, and as always, I am joined by my lovely and wonderful wife, Anitra.
That's me.
And we have already started talking about the games that we've been playing. As promised, this week, we are going to talk about spring cleaning.
Do you spring clean your board games?
I mean, doing it now.
We do.
We're pre-spring cleaning our board games.
Because it's definitely not spring here yet.
It's painful. This is a difficult process.
You're not Marie Kondoing. They all spark joy.
I can't cry on the games because they're made of cardboard and that would damage them. But games bring me joy. Anyway, I don't want to talk about that too much. We're going to talk about that the second half of the show. As always, we are going to start the show talking about what we've been playing. We already hit Order of Invention, which is a game that we've been playing.
Mm-hmm.
What else is on the list, honey?
Well, as we were remarking, it's not quite spring cleaning because at least here in Massachusetts, it is not spring.
That's true.
We have had a lot of snowstorms, and so because of that, our kids have had a lot of snow delays and one or two snow days.
Yeah, what's the deal with that? Like, the two-hour delay is the super common thing now because that way kids don't lose days of school and have to... I want them in school as long as possible.
Well, you say that now, except that the end of school is probably going to coincide with me being away at Origins.
Never. Yeah, I do want them in school.
But you don't want to deal with, like, it's the last day of school, also the first day that mom is gone. Hooray!
Right. So I want more snow days,
is what
I'm saying.
So you want more snow days.
And less two-hour delays.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying.
All right, fair.
I'm saying if there's snow days, that's fine. But the two-hour delays are like, they still get credit for the day of school.
Yeah.
But
I understand why they do it.
I'm only kidding.
I understand why they do it, but in all honesty, as a parent, I hate it because it means, especially with our youngest only being in half-day school, instead of having the morning to myself, I get nothing. I get lots of extra driving around and shoveling the snow. But having snow days and snow delays means we had a lot more time to play games, the kids and me, because you still have to work.
Poor Andrew.
So sad. We've been playing a lot of cool stuff. We finally pulled out, for the first time since PAX, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, a gemstone mining game.
Yeah, we played this at the USIOPLY booth with Ross Thompson, who is the man, and he gave us a great demo of this game. We did a little bit of an interview with him. This is essentially a retheming of the game Quartz.
Yeah. It's worth mentioning, we liked it enough that when we got back to our rooms the first night of PAX, we pulled it out and played a full game.
Right.
But then we haven't had time to play it again since. So we played it. It's a really interesting press your luck, you're drawing gems out of a bag mechanic. You want to press your luck so you can get the most points that is possible on your turn. But you don't want to press too hard because, you know, it's a press your luck game. If you pull too many, I forget what they're supposed to be, not coal, obsidian. If you pull too many black gems out, then you get nothing. So it's been an interesting game to play with the back and forth. You want to get the good gems, but you also don't want to make people too jealous of you, because the thing about this game, the gemstone mining game, is there are a lot of cards that let you mess up other people's finds. So you don't want to get too far ahead or everybody's going to gang up on you. I think we had a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to playing it some more. But I figured it was worth mentioning that we actually played it and it was good.
Yep, it's a lot of fun. I didn't get to play it with you, but I have played it before and I very much enjoy it.
We pulled out a couple of classics that haven't been played much over the last 6 months or a year, like Rolling America and Battleship. That was good. I finally pulled out and played with our older two kids, The Scrambled States of America. Literally the last time we played this, even our oldest was not really old enough to play the game yet. It was about four or five years ago. So that one, just you and I had played way back in the day. This time, pulling it out with kids who can read and have a good sense of where the states are, we had a lot of fun. We played the kinder, gentler version where everybody who has a state that matches whatever the condition is on each round, everybody who matched could score on that round. The less kind version is the first person to slap one of their states that matches is the only person who gets it. But we had a good time with it. It's a great game for learning some of that geography and facts. Unlike 10 Days in the USA, which we've talked about before, which is literally just the geography of what states are next to what states. Scrambled States of America, each card has the state name on it, the state motto, the capital, and one other fact about the state. And the different cards that come out have you look for different things. So sometimes it's as simple as the state that's the farthest east. But sometimes it's a state that has a person's name in the capital, which could be St. Paul, Minnesota, or it could be Augusta, Maine.
Annapolis, Maryland?
Sure, that's got the name Anne in it. So it definitely gets you thinking more about all of these different facts about the states, and some of them are going to stick. So we had a good time with that one.
Cool.
On the opposite end of the scale, Elliot asked me to play Go Away Monster, and then both of the older two kids said, can I play too? So we all played Go Away Monster together, and that was fun and friendly, mostly. But let's talk about a new game.
Sure,
well,
let's do it.
New to us, anyway.
A game I've played, maybe.
Yes!
All right, awesome.
Let's do that. You pulled out the other night Kokoro, Avenue of the Kodama.
I did. So this was a game that I picked up as part of the No Shit Math Trade at PAX Unplugged, and it was an interesting looking game on the list, and so I checked it off and said, sure, I'd like that. I don't even remember what the trade actually ended up being, because it's not a one-to-one
kind of
thing.
It's not a one-to-one trade.
But I was looking for something relatively short to play one night, and we were kind of on our way to bed, but I hadn't played a game in so long. I mean, you had played plenty, but I hadn't played a game in so long. And so I went up to... Two of our cubes of our Kallax are designated for games that we really want to get to the table, you guys know, seriously.
Yeah.
And I was looking through those, trying to find something relatively small, and my eyes landed upon Kokoro Avenue of the Kodama. So I picked it up, and we actually sat down in bed and played the game.
Yeah, which was great. So Kokoro is a game where everybody has a whiteboard that you're going to draw a path on.
Yeah, so a lot of people right now are talking about Railroad Ink. Right, which there's a red Railroad Ink and a blue Railroad Ink. I don't really know anything about the game in particular, but it looks like it's got some of that same kind of path drawing mechanic on a whiteboard. So if you played that, you can kind of think about that when thinking about Kokoro.
Yeah, so in Kokoro, you're flipping over cards. The first card you flip over is telling you, you want to connect things to this shrine, it's called. They're
right.
A, B, C, D, E,
F,
I think.
F, maybe. I think it goes to G.
But you want to connect the little bugs and flowers to a specific shrine in each round. And then you start flipping over cards that show you an exact path segment that you must draw somewhere on your board. They all need to be oriented correctly. There's no rotating in this game.
Right.
And all of the paths have one exit and one entrance. So they will only hit two sides of your square block.
Right. So what you have in front of you on your whiteboard is a grid. It's like a 10 by 10 or 12 by 12 grid. And these, as these tiles are revealed, both players have to put that path on one of the squares of their grid. And obviously, in the beginning, the first couple are probably the same or similar. Mm-hmm. But one thing that's really interesting about this game is that there are also, there's like the god of...
It's the caterpillar guardian and the flower guardian.
Exactly. The flower guardian, the caterpillar guardian. And so along with connecting to each of these shrines every round, you also want to be connecting the caterpillar guardian to caterpillars in a path, and the flower guardian to flowers in a path. So that's kind of a meta goal that's running throughout the entire game. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a path that doesn't quite work for you, maybe it's something that you can use in your guardian path somewhere in order to make their goal, which is only scored at the end of the game, a little bit better.
One other important thing to note about Kokoro is in each round, you must score higher than you did the round before. Otherwise, for that round, you get a zero, which in endgame scoring turns into -5.
Right. It's kind of a weird scoring thing, but what it does is it allows you to kind of reboot your score, ramping up thing.
But it also makes it so that you're always trying to look for exactly the right balance. You don't want to score too high early in the game because then you're guaranteeing yourself a zero.
Right. One thing that we figured out after playing this game once, or at least me, I don't know, maybe you figured it out the first time because you're smarter than I am, is that when you connect a shrine to some stuff, that path is still available.
Oh, yeah.
So you can connect another shrine into the same path.
Which pretty much guarantees you a higher
You get all
score.
Of those points from the first one, plus any additional stuff. And so by the end of the game, if you've managed to have one contiguous path, like, which I think you
really
did
well.
At one point.
Yep.
You had like one round with like 70 points or something crazy like that.
It was not quite that high, but it was ridiculous.
That is a great way, you know, strategically to excel at this game. But I love this game because it supports like 2 to 8 players or something like that. It's a huge range.
Yeah, well, it's one of those games that really has no player interaction. So you could play it just as easily.
I suppose if you
solo.
Had 2 copies of the game, you could support. It's really however many people that you have boards for. However many people you have boards for. I suppose you could even photocopy the board.
Just do it with pencil or something.
And do it
with
a bajillion people or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean. but it's easy to play. You can play it anywhere. It's a relatively small box.
Yeah.
It comes with the markers in the box, which I really appreciate a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The markers have erasers on them, which I really appreciate a lot.
Yes. I appreciated it a lot when I played it with the kids the next day, and Elliot wanted to play, and we basically just gave him a board and a marker and let him have at it.
Just color, pal. But, I mean, you can play it in bed. You know, the only thing that you really need to preserve is that you've got a stack of shrine cards, and you can just flip one over and right on top, and then you've got a stack of the path cards, and you can do kind of the same thing.
More or less, yeah.
There's a little bit of complexity because each round ends once you've flipped over 4 golden path cards, but we managed
to make
it work, like I said, on the bed. So that gives a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun playing that.
Yeah, I did too.
It's from Indie Board Games and Cards.
All right, more Snow Day games. Claire specifically asked me to play Ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
The balance is definitely different when you play that with 2 players. It's still well-balanced, but there's less you have to keep track of, and so it feels significantly easier to really get your points up.
Okay.
But we had fun with that. That was one of our big hit games of end of 2017, early 2018.
Right.
Yeah. You and I finally sat down and learned how to play Circle the Wagons.
We did. We played one whole game of it.
One whole game. This was the most famous game to come out of Button Shy. Until Sprawlopolis came out.
Until Sprawlopolis, right. And there's a definite similarity between those 2 games.
Well, they're by the same designers.
Right.
So that shouldn't be a huge surprise.
Right.
But Circle the Wagons is a competitive game, unlike Sprawlopolis, which is cooperative. And in Circle the Wagons, it kind of has the feeling of card drafting, but you're doing it with 2 people, so it's all open out on the table.
Right.
I really liked it. It felt thinky in a slightly different way than Sprawlopolis, because you were keeping track of different stuff while you're building your little, you know, Wild West boomtown.
Right. Yeah, there were 1 or 2 of the goals that I went after that you didn't really care about. So it was really interesting to see the scoring.
You and I went after very different goals, which was neat. Claire dragged you into playing a game of Sparkle Kitty or 2.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of acted put upon. I didn't really mind.
I mean,
it wasn't a problem. But I will say this. She demolished us.
The first game wasn't even fun, honestly, because Claire is really good at speed games, and she got just the right hand of cards that she was able to keep doing the double play, which is out of turn. If you have an exact match, you can put it down and yell double.
I gotta be honest with you, I didn't even think this was a speed game thing. I think it was just a result of she had the perfect cards in her hand, and I think I literally had one or two turns and the game was over.
And the game was over.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what that really does, though, is it illuminates something that... It's just, it's a little tough with that game, and sometimes it just happens that way, that the perfectly wrong or perfectly right cards come out, and there's really nothing that you can do about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a game that's mostly built on randomness and a tiny bit of strategy. So when you have that much randomness, sometimes random things happen.
Yep, but, I mean, we had a good time. We played twice. I lost both times.
Yeah.
It was fun.
But it was fun.
That's another game from Breaking Games, by the way.
Yes. I was super excited. I finally got my first shipment from the Board Game of the Month Club.
Congratulations.
And around the time they sent out the shipments, they also posted online episode 0 of Tempest Quest. And Tempest Quest is the little roll and write type game that's getting packaged a new episode in every month. I really like this style of game. It's designed by Chris Anderson. I already like his game Tempest Imperium, which is a freely available roll and write. And Tempest Quest is all set in this science fiction-y world that already exists for a couple of other Button Shy games. I don't know the exact name of it. But in Tempest Quest Zero, you're trying to repair a spaceship in time before, like, the guard towers catch you or the alarm level reaches maximum. It's like a roll and write, except there are no dice. Your abilities and your starting setup are solely determined by the day, hour, and minute that you start playing. It's a really clever setup. I really like playing with it. I was excited to see it in this new format, and I am super excited to keep playing these games as they come out month after month from Button Shy for all of 2019. So if this sounds interesting to you, think about signing up for the Board Game of the Month Club. I think you get Tempest Quest even if you sign up at the $1 level.
Sweet.
All right. What else?
So we've been working through the games that we really want to get to the table. And this past week, we actually got to play through two different exit games.
Yeah. We really do like doing exit boxes and unlock boxes. But it requires a certain time investment and person investment.
Yeah, I'm not smart enough to do them without other people. So so we do have to get some friends over. And it was a week that was miraculously not crushed full of stuff. So we actually had friends over twice.
Yes, but we told them ahead of time, rather than learn a new game or work on other stuff, because we've been pretty busy.
Mm-hmm.
We were just going to do some of these exit boxes because they're fun and interesting.
So we did the Polar Station.
Mm-hmm. That was super creepy.
Which was creepy. With the intelligent black ooze.
Ugh.
And we did the Pharaoh's Tomb.
That one was really neat.
It was fun.
And I don't only say that because we got the perfect 10 stars.
Yeah, we destroyed it. Which was surprising to me because it was ranked as one of the expert level exit boxes. But other than one or two times when we were kind of stumped and almost flailing a little bit, I think we pretty much had a good handle on it the whole time.
The Pharaoh's Tomb, it happened to be one of those setups where we had exactly the right
brains
to work on it together.
Right.
So we never flailed on anything very long.
Mm-hmm. There was one point where you just said, okay, you go over here in this corner with this puzzle and figure it out and come back.
Well, there's also one where everybody was looking at this one puzzle and kind of working on figuring it out. I had been doing something else. I was like, what are you guys doing? Obviously, this is the answer. And they kind of looked at me like, wait, what?
That was fun.
So that was a good time.
Great.
I
want to be vague. I don't want to give anything away. So those were fun.
Without being overly obvious, I really like that in a lot of the exit boxes, not every single one, but a lot of them, the designers have found a way to include a puzzle in the story that makes you look back at the physical box itself.
Right.
So, not giving anything more away than that, but I like that level of cleverness in there.
They think both inside and outside the box.
Yes, they do.
Sometimes more than once.
Sometimes both at the same time.
Right.
Ooh.
We also got a chance to play Shikoku a few times. This is a game that's available for pre-order right now at GrandGamersGuild.com. It's a game that Mark Spector, who is a friend of the show, is localizing to the United States. It has been published internationally before, and we got our greasy little hands on a copy of it.
Temporarily,
to try out a few times. And I really like that game a lot.
I like it a lot, too. And it definitely needs the localization for the rules.
Yes, the rule book is a little hit or miss.
I am really glad Mark showed us how to play it, so I could just refer back to the rules.
Right. And so we had a game night at our church last night, and we brought Shikoku with us.
Yeah, and that was great. I first grabbed it when we ended up with a table of like five people, and I was like, oh, well, this is a good game for five people or more. And we ended up actually playing it with seven people.
Right. I think that's the max?
Eight is the max.
Okay.
Assorted ages from teenager through grandparent. And we all had a really good time with it. Shikoku has this definite sort of stop, start, jerky feel, but definitely on purpose.
Right. Push, pull.
Yeah, because you're thing. Well, because you're trying to be either second or second to last when the game ends.
Right.
So you want to push people ahead of you most of the time, but every once in a while, then you're going to try to run and catch up. It was really interesting that in our seven-player game, the field kind of spread out slowly over the course of the game. We stayed together for a while, and then it slowly spread out. And for the last two rounds of the game, we had two distinct groups. The group in front was fighting for second place, and the group in back was fighting for second to last.
Right, which is great.
Which was great. I had so much fun with that. And in fact, I was in the group in the back. In the end, it came down to simply which cards we played, because one of us ended up moving two, one moved three, and one moved four from us all being in a line together. That is one of the interesting aspects to Shikoku as well, which is as you lay out your movement cards, they all get placed in order. There are numbers from 1 to 33 on the top of the cards. And once everybody has played out their cards, they're all there in order. The person who's second and the person who's second to last don't move. So most of the time, you want to avoid those. You want to move. You want to be able to keep going. But especially near the end of the game, those two spots end up being the most fought over, saying, no, I don't want to move. Please, you know, maneuver me into that spot. And so at the end of the game, our little group at the back, two out of the three of us at least, were fighting for one of those spots where you don't move. And it ended up that none of us got it. So we all moved our little amount forward. I'm really enjoying this game. I like that it teaches a certain amount of patience as well as number theory, because you're always looking at what numbers are out, what's already been played, what's still available, and trying to work out your odds of the card that you play actually taking you where you want to go.
Right. It is definitely interesting. It really flies in the face of that win at all costs kind of idea, because you at least on a round by round basis, you sometimes deliberately don't want to, air quote, win.
You don't want to always get ahead. Right. Yeah. You really want to stay in the pack a lot of the time. We had a lot of fun with it. It has a little bit of trouble in that it's hard to explain, but once you get one or two rounds in, everybody understands and you're often playing.
Right.
No problem.
Totally agree. I finally, after 3 years or so, I got to play Campaign Trail last night.
At the church game night. You guys looked like you were having fun. Independence!
Yeah, I think we were playing from about 6 to about 8.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So, we had a really good time. I was the presidential candidate. We played a four-player game, so there was a president and a vice president on both the Republican and the Democratic side. I was the presidential candidate for the Republicans. We flipped California, New York, Massachusetts, and kept Florida. But we lost Texas, but we won.
All right. This is one of the great things about Campaign Trail, though, is it takes something that we already have stories about in our American culture.
Right.
And it captures that part really well. So when you finish the game, you use the same vocabulary that we use in our elections, and you have a story to tell about how the game went.
Well, and the other thing that's really interesting about this, and we have a friend who's an AP American history teacher, and I was talking to him about it this morning, is as the strategy of the game unfolded, you really could hear the people talking in almost the same ways that when they get like a Republican strategist on C-SPAN, they're like, well, they've got to invest their money in Pennsylvania and Ohio because if they flip those states, then da-da-da. And it was just really interesting to see the way the game was unfolding. There was a flurry of activity on the East Coast, and it slowly spread west until somebody flew from, I think, Baltimore to California to do some stuff there. So it really, it really looked in a lot of ways like an election looks. The game does, it kind of drags a little bit. We actually took about a third of the deck out before we allocated the cards out.
I was going to say that was Corey's suggestion, right?
Just to bring it down a little bit. And I think it's a big part of that is because two of the people had never played the game before.
Sure.
But it's a great game. I mean, it's a monster on the table.
So big.
I don't even know if we could get that game on our table without the table extension in it. I mean, it's huge. Our table without the extension is a 5-foot by 3-foot table, and it would be tough.
Yeah, it would. I was going to say that we managed to get it on the old table.
I think the board is bigger than the...
But that was the prototype, and there weren't all of the extra little player boards and stuff that there is now.
Oh my gosh, it's so big, and there's so many pieces. But one nice thing about playing it, and I did an unboxing, and the unboxing is on Facebook. There's just a ton of stuff in this 10-pound box. One nice thing about playing it is I could really isolate which pieces are extraneous and throw them away.
So that there's just a little bit less.
Yeah, exactly. And that was actually quite helpful.
Good.
But it's a blast of a game to play. The spot varnish looks so good on that board. I mean, it's so good. And it was a lot of fun.
All right. Well, while you were playing that, I played Shikoku. And then we also played Visitor in Blackwood Grove.
Yeah, which I'm sure you had a much better time with than I did because you didn't have a clue giver who, you know, was awful. I was the clue giver when I played.
Well, in fact, the clue giver, the visitor, is our friend Dave, who had played with us before.
Right, so he knew not to have a horrible rule in this game.
His rule was fantastic, actually. It ended up being, he told me when we finished the game, his rule was things you would typically find in a kitchen. Which was great because it's the kind of rule that you're probably not going to be able to specifically state out loud as one of the guessers and say, right, this is the rule. But it's got that right amount of intuitiveness. I was one of the agents and I actually managed to prove the rule. That's what it's called in the game. Which is to say, once you have enough clues that you think you know what the rule feels like, you set out 4 cards, you let the visitor, the clue giver, predict which ones are in and which ones are out. And then you predict which ones would go in and which ones would stay out. And then the clue giver reveals, and if it matches, you've won the game.
Congratulations, you have won the game.
So I realized we started with fire and a glass of water. Both of those went in inside the force field. And then, like, I had put out another piece of food, and that went in. And then there were some obvious non-food items like file folders and something else, a cardboard box. And so the more I looked at things, the more I was like, well, this is like food and stuff similar to food, like involved like food with
food. Adjacent things.
Food adjacent items.
Right.
So I just set out like papers and books and pants and something else. And I'm like, none of these are going to go in. I have proved the rule.
I don't know. Our 4-year-old gets a lot of food on its pants.
Well, that's true, but I don't think you normally find pants in a kitchen unless they're attached to a person. So it worked out well for me. It was interesting to work through the game.
Sure.
It does suffer from the problem that for a simple concept, the rules of the game are kind of hard to explain.
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit after, and I think when we do a review of Visitor in Blackwood Grove, I think we'll go into it in a little bit more depth, but it is hard to put together rules around a game like this. And basically, we thought it would be better if you slowly introduced more of the mechanics as you played the game.
If you could come up with some sort of tutorial system,
yep,
to teach the different aspects. Because I will say, our player who was assigned the role of the kid, who's technically teamed up with the alien, but you don't really get to give any extra information, He was having a hard time understanding because there's this whole thing with trust levels, and when the trust level is at this stage, right, then you can do this.
Yep.
And I understand that. I don't think he played poorly. I think he might have been able to make different decisions if he understood it better.
Right.
That said, we had a great time with it.
Mm-hmm.
I am slowly learning better ways to explain aspects of the game. Like, as an agent, you're not actually predicting whether or not things go through the force field that the alien has set up. You're basically just taking whatever you have at hand and chucking it at the force field and see if it bounces off or goes in.
Right.
I mean, it works as an analogy. It makes sense.
So it's, you know, it got some issues, but I think that ultimately the core game is still a great game.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do too.
And it's something that I'm looking forward to playing more. Maybe I won't be the one giving the hints, or I'll just do a better job.
Yeah, you know, both. I want to call out our son Asher and give him some public praise for a moment. If you remember, several weeks ago, he sat down to play Fire in the Library with me and just had a terrible time. Mm-hmm. And I let him stop partway through.
Right.
And then taught myself the solo mode, which was great. On one of our snow delay days, he sat down with me and tried to play again. He does not enjoy this game. He stuck it out to the end. I promised him I am not going to ask him to play it anymore.
Poor guy.
But I'm really proud of him for trying again and sticking with it.
Right. I mean, even the one time that I played Fire in the Library, and I actually liked the game, I was getting burned by ridiculous luck at the beginning, and then I came back and obliterated other
at
people
the end, yeah,
because of ridiculous luck again. Yeah. And it was, I just don't want it to be that way. So it's just sometimes, you know, just like Sparkle Kitty, it just kind of happens sometimes.
Yeah, the more I look at it, Fire in the Library has a very similar set of mechanics to that Snow White gemstone mining game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe Snow White does it just a little bit better or more fair feeling, I guess, would be the better way to put it. Although I like the theme better in Fire in the Library.
Sure.
Because, of course, I do.
Bibliophile.
Books! Books everywhere! One last thing. We were at a restaurant with your family and our kids, and we pulled out Get the MacGuffin.
We did.
We had a great time with it. It's silly fun.
It's such a fun game.
But we're going to talk about it in a snap review, so I'll leave it at that.
Oh, yeah. We sure will. That means it's time for a break.
All right. I could use a break.
All right. We'll be back to talk about spring cleaning after this.
Snap review is for Get the MacGuffin, a quick game of player elimination for 2 to 11 players from Andrew Looney at Looney Labs.
Mm-hmm. Game is rated for ages 8 plus, and it's a really quick game. It lasts about 5 to 10 minutes, even when you're all the way up at 10 or 11 players.
10 or 11 players, yep. The goal of the game is to be the last person who still has at least one card, either in your hand or in play on the table.
So to start the game, you shuffle the cards and give each player an equal number of cards. Whatever is left over, you just put in a stack. They're completely out of the game.
Well, almost completely out.
Almost completely out. On your turn, you either play a card from your hand or you use an object that you have previously played that is sitting in front of you to perform some kind of special power.
So there are two kinds of cards you can have in your hand. Actions and objects. Actions are all a one-time use. They can be as innocuous as Shrugmaster, which says, shrug.
I like the hippie, which is, flash the peace sign when you play this card.
But some of them are really nasty, like, can I use that, where you draw a card from somebody else's hand and use it as your own? Or the switcheroo, trade hands with another player, even if that means they end up with no cards. Some of them are just completely random, like the vortex, in which you collect everyone's hands of cards and redeal them all.
And some of them are silly. I already mentioned the hippie. There's the Grand Marshal, which is wave at everyone as you play this card.
So the second kind of card are objects. Objects are all cards that you would play out to the table and then later use for a special ability on a future turn.
One of my favorite objects is the crown. You are now king or queen of the game, and everyone must address you as Your Majesty.
One of the key parts of Get the MacGuffin is to have the right objects that will allow you to keep playing even as you lose or play all the cards out of your hand. obviously the most desirable one is...
the MacGuffin.
What is a MacGuffin? Really just anything good.
Right. So on your turn, if you don't have a card in your hand that you can play, you have to discard one of your objects.
Right. So the MacGuffin special power is if you have no other cards in hand and no other objects in play, you don't have to discard the MacGuffin. You can simply pick it up and put it back down as its special power.
But of course, if you have the MacGuffin in your hand at the beginning of the game, you don't necessarily want to play it right away because there's so many cards that can take your items away from you.
Like the money. That's an object. You play it to the table, but on a later turn, you can use that money to buy someone else's card.
Or if you're particularly vindictive and you have the Fist of Doom in your hand, you can play this card to discard an object and force someone to discard the MacGuffin.
Exactly.
Fortunately, there is a backup.
The backup MacGuffin.
Which functions as the MacGuffin only if the MacGuffin is not in play.
Right. And there's even a backup to that. The crown itself acts as sort of a backup MacGuffin. So this is a very well-designed game in that it is exceedingly unlikely that everyone will go out at the same time and no one will be able to play. There's pretty much always a very clear winner.
But the game is also silly. There's objects for rock, paper, and scissors, which all obviously defeat the other appropriate objects when you use them. The game is just a boatload of fun. It's a game that is a fantastic filler. We said it lasts 5 to 10 minutes, so no matter how many players there are. This game spans age ranges extremely well because the mechanics are very simple.
Yeah, really the only things that kids need to be able to handle to play this game is a fair bit of reading comprehension, which is why it says ages 8 and up, and they need to be able to handle being eliminated. If your kids can't deal with player elimination, this is definitely not the game for you.
That's true. Fortunately, though, the cards are large, the pictures are very stylized, and it's a fantastic spectator game as well.
So
the player elimination, while disappointing, is not as crushing as it could be in a game where it's kind of boring to watch other people play.
Yes, agreed. We've found that Get the MacGuffin makes a great icebreaker with people you don't know well. It makes a great restaurant game because it plays so quickly. According to the rules, you can even play this in an environment where you don't have a table, like waiting in line. Because you can just, instead of playing your objects to the table, you can simply hold them face out with your hand. One of the times we played this with a large group, somebody spoke up and mentioned that Get the MacGuffin feels a lot like Flux, but faster and simpler. That shouldn't be a surprise. It was designed by the same people.
So you can go to Amazon right now and get a copy of Get the MacGuffin for just over $10. It's an inexpensive game. It is a ball of fun to play. I will admit it did take a couple of plays to grow on me.
Yes.
So I do recommend if you like Flux, if you like that kind of silly game, if you like the humor of Munchkin, even if you don't like the mechanics of Munchkin, this is the kind of game that you would enjoy.
Yeah. In my opinion, Get the MacGuffin is a fantastic family game, in part because it plays so quickly, allows for such a huge variation in player count, and it's got some strategy, but a lot of randomness, so really anybody can win.
I completely agree with you. So, Nature, what do you think we'll give Get the MacGuffin?
I've enjoyed it so much, I think we give Get the MacGuffin 4.5 stars.
All right, I completely agree with you. It is a great game. It's not for everybody. Deep strategy gamers are probably not going to enjoy this, but I think it does appeal to a wide range. It's a fantastic family game. 4.5 stars for Get the MacGuffin.
And that's Get the MacGuffin.
In a snap.
And we're back.
You know, we did so much game-wise that we didn't even mention what we did yesterday.
Yeah, we did a live show is not the right term. We did a live recording.
Mm-hmm. A combined show live recording.
Flip Flory Super Saturday Family Gamers.
Family Gamers, Board Game, Serial.
Family Feud.
Not Family Feud. Can't use those words.
Sorry.
Super Saturday Family Gamers Serial Battle of Wits.
Battle of Twits, you say?
Battle of Wits.
Oh, okay.
It was a lot of fun. We had an absolute blast. Chris Michaud, a.k.a. your moderator, Chris, was our moderator. He was wonderful.
He was great.
Yep. Team Flip Flory featured famed board game designer Gil Hova.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We featured our kids.
You know, like we do.
Yep. We got to do a live board game in the middle, which was a blast.
That was fun.
Yep. Yep. We had a really, really fun time. And I'm not going to tell you who won with our two teams.
You're going to have to wait and hear that next week.
Yep. Yeah, we're going to include it in our feed. It's going to be our episode 137.
So look for that next week. In the meantime, spring cleaning or how I learned to stop worrying and get rid of board games.
I mean, worry is not the word that I want to use here. I mean, I've always thought I had a high pain threshold.
Mental pain threshold, maybe not quite as high.
Yeah, maybe not.
So this is not just because of the success of Marie Kondo's Netflix show, although that has provided countless memes.
Right. It totally has.
Our shelves are overflowing, and so it was time for us personally to take a hard look at what we had and what we actually want to keep around.
Right. So we mentioned Alaska a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. and I don't even remember if we mentioned it on the show, but the night before we left, we were up a little bit late packing, and then I decided to just stay up. I cataloged our board games, and including expansions, we had hit like 400.
Yeah.
And that was just a lot.
Some people might not think it's a lot, but for us in our house, you know, with the kids and everything else, we look at that, we're like, all of the shelf space we have allocated to board games is not just full, but overflowing, you know, board games on top, board games in piles on the sides. It's too much.
Right, right. And especially since we're trying to encourage our kids and say, you have a limited amount of space for your toys, we felt like it was incumbent on us as parents to be good examples.
Yes.
And they know that we love board games, and so we're yes. taking those steps to purge, to yes. clean up. And the funny thing is that we've now eliminated about 25 games,
mm-hmm.
about 20 games, because we ended up trading some of them. And it doesn't really feel like we have more space, but the space doesn't look as just crammed full, right?
Yeah, it is now a little overfull rather than, what are we going to do with all these games?
Right, right. And I think that probably we have another 25 to 50 to go.
I think so. We're still working on it. But as we started working on it, we figured we would ask all of you, how do you make these hard decisions? How do you cull board games?
Right. And we got a lot of great feedback from our listeners.
We sure did. On Twitter, on Facebook. I asked on our last email newsletter, and I got a few emails in return.
Mm-hmm.
So my personal favorite from early on in this process is that Katie Adley, who tweets at Katie's Game Corner, on Twitter, we said, you know, do you have any advice? And she said, you have to be strong and savage.
Right. Is it really a surprise that she reviews war games, by the way?
Yeah, not so much.
On Facebook, Jeremy Skirdless said that what they did is they went through all of their games and they said, if I asked you to play this right now, would you? Any game that had multiple, three or more, yes answers went back on the shelf. It was hard for me on some because I really like the game, but if nobody wants to play it with me, then it isn't fun. And that is what games are supposed to be.
Which is so true.
It is.
That's like what I was talking about with Fire in the Library. If Asher doesn't want to play it with me, it's not going to be fun to play it with him anymore.
Right. I really want to talk about what we did with the kids, because that was something kind of sort of similar to what Jeremy's talking about here, but let's keep looking.
Let's look at some more of the feedback. Nick, the inestimable Nick Martinelli, says, I haven't needed to call because he does lots of research before he buys games. He did later tell us that doesn't count the, you know, mass market games that somehow managed to sneak into every gamer parent's house.
I just think he probably hasn't accepted the fact that he probably needs to call some games.
You heard it here, Nick. You need to call games.
Jim Cushman said, in an effort to spend more one-on-one time, cull the collection, and reduce the shelf of shame, my wife and I are going to start playing a couple of games a week to purely assess if we think our two boys will potentially want to play the game when they are older.
His boys are really young right now. Like
Jim, we're going to check in with you and see if you've had success in playing a couple of games. I'm just kidding. But we'd love to hear back from you if you do actually successfully manage to do this.
But I think this is a great solution because it does all sorts of things at once. Yes, you're reducing the shelf of shame. Yes, you're culling. But you're also specifically setting aside time to play the games, enjoy each other's company while you're evaluating whether or not to keep them.
Right. And that's kind of the premise behind our these are the games we really need to play, you guys.
Yes. Our listener, Duena, said that her first priority is the player count. Most of the time, her family's either playing two players or three players. And if a game doesn't shine at either one of those player counts, it has to have a different, stronger reason to keep it around.
Mm-hmm. She said that the games that don't make the cut, they donate to their local library so they can still visit them sometimes. Aww. Like family. Peter L. said, our household has two tiers of games. We pick up a lot of games at yard sales, auctions, or on clearance. If we like them, we keep them. If we don't, no big deal. It wasn't expensive, and it's easy to let them go. However, if we pay full retail price for a game, then it is an investment, and not keeping it would be like admitting we made a mistake.
That's one of the hard parts of culling the collection down.
You know, some of it for me actually is that it's okay to make an investment in something and use, quote, use it up.
Yeah.
And say, okay, I bought this thing. I have played with this thing. I've gotten my money's worth out of this thing. I am prepared to move on from this thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, maybe playing a little bit of Pandemic Legacy or playing those exit boxes, which are destructible and you can't play them again. Maybe that helps me a little bit with that. By saying, like, okay, I mean, I played with the game and it's done.
And now it's done.
I've used it up.
Yeah.
Right.
Joe Cummings, who blogs on Art of Board Gaming, he asked himself, how much do I really like this game? Is there another game in my collection I would always choose over this one? He gave some examples. There's a game called Airlines Europe. He loves it, and he wouldn't turn down playing it if somebody asked. But in a regular game night, he and his wife would probably choose Stockpile instead. They're both stock-themed games. So why keep them both? He also asked himself with the games, how realistic is it that I will play this game within the next year or two? If it's not coming off the shelf and you don't love it, it's just taking up space.
Yeah, there's a few games that actually fall into this category for me. Twilight Struggle is probably the top of the list.
Yeah. Right?
The only people that I'm probably going to successfully play Twilight Struggle with physically have a copy.
Yeah. He later continued in his email, he sold off a lot of great games. And he says, but in hindsight, I don't really miss any of them because I still have plenty of great games to play. Joe also wrote an article on how to cull your board game collection. We're going to link to it in the show notes, but just go to artofboardgaming.com and look in the how-tos section.
Joseph from Maryland, different Joseph, said the criteria for letting go of games, like prying them from my oh-so-reluctant fingers, is varied. Some games only I like. No one else in the family or immediate friends enjoys it. So I'd rather have some shelf space or cash for some new or different stuff. Some games ran their cycle of playing. We felt like there was nothing new to explore. That's kind of what I was
saying
before.
That's what you were mentioning, yep.
Or enjoy and hadn't been played in a long while and honestly had no intention of playing again. Some games we just flat out didn't like and wanted to send on to someone else who would enjoy them.
Those are all good reasons to cull.
Right.
So thank you, all of you listeners who gave us feedback. This is not an exhaustive list, but we tried to capture several different pieces of how and why people call their board game collections.
Yep.
So now let's talk about what we've been doing, how we've been making the hard decisions of what stays and what goes.
Yeah, some of the stuff, it's not, do we play this game or not? If not, let's just get rid of it. Because
right.
Some of the games, I mean, we've talked a lot about Machikoro and how Machikoro is kind of falling out of favor in our family. And
yeah.
It's not because there's anything wrong with Machikoro. It's just that there's games that have come out since then that have really expanded on that mechanic. Right. So that's a great example of, it's not, do we or do we not, you know, play this or do we not like this? It's just, it's gotten us to the next level. Right.
Yeah,
but it served a purpose. I mentioned the kids games before. This is what I did with the kids. And I thought that this actually was really, really helpful. For me, and I'll tell you the story of one game that went through this process. So I pulled all the kids' games off of the shelves. We had, I think, 8 cubes full of just games for the kids.
Yes.
And so we pulled all of them off and put them in a big pile. And one or two of the games, actually, I was like, okay, this is really an adult game. I don't even know why it's down there, but, you know.
Sure.
It was like Century Golem Edition was an example.
I know exactly why that one was
I
down
mean,
there.
Yeah, I do too. And here's something that was really interesting. If you think about doing something like this, at the beginning, the kids were really, really possessive over which games were theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to explain to them, this isn't about saying which games are yours so that nobody else can play them. It's about making sure that games that you want to keep are kept.
Yes.
And so we have 3 kids. So we said, each one of you gets a cube to put whatever games you want in.
That you want to make sure stay.
And there's 2 cubes of shared games. So it was really, really difficult with our kids to say, listen, you don't have to be possessive over this, because if multiple kids wants it, then just put it on a shared shelf.
Yeah.
Because it was really kind of getting almost fractious with them. They were like, no, this is mine. No, this is mine. I was like, well, if you both want it, just put it on the shared shelf. And it was really difficult for them to think through what that meant and what a game being shared really meant. And instead of this really kind of territorial thought process around their stuff, saying, I'm using my space to preserve what I want, but it's not about being possessive of my things. Does that make sense?
I mean, it's kids, so they're still going to be kind of possessive.
But I had to remind them of this like 4 or 5 times, and eventually I think they started to understand what I was saying, but it took a while.
Sure. Well, and there are obvious choices like this, like Mall Madness. Our boys will play it. It is Claire's game. She bought it with her own money. If she wants to get rid of it, it's going to go.
Right.
She didn't want to get rid of it.
No, of course not. That's fine.
But, you know, that was a very clear cut one. But, for example, Century Golem Edition, that one would be everybody saying, like, Asher would say, well, you bought this game for me. And Claire saying, it's really a family game. Everybody should play it. When really all we're looking for is this a game that you all love and play? Great. Let's keep it.
Right. I mean, the key was, look, I'm not going to tell someone you can't get a game out of someone else's cube because it's their game.
Yeah.
That was never the question.
Right.
But it was really interesting to watch the kids work through the part where they had to realize, this isn't a solo game. I'm going to need other people to play this with me.
Yep.
It's not about being possessive.
Yep.
Right? It was really, really interesting to do that. And I think we got rid of 6 or 7 games just doing that.
For what it's worth, you did this with the older two kids when I was out with Elliot.
Right.
I came back with Elliot, and the two of them had kind of said, oh, well, this is Elliot's game, and this is Elliot's game, and these are games for him. And so I had him sit down and look at this much smaller collection.
Right.
And he said, I don't want that game. I don't care about that game. I definitely do want this one. Go Away Monster needs to stay, Mommy.
Yeah. Well, and some of them we knew he was going to.
Right. But, like, they made their best guesses, and there were a couple where, you know, maybe they liked to play them, these games, when they were 4 years old, but he doesn't care about them. And if they don't want to play them now, there's no reason to keep them around anymore.
Right. So they went through this whole process, and then there was one game that they put on the cull pile that I pulled out of the cull pile and put in the shared games. Do you know what game that was?
What game was it?
It was Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, yeah. They did ask me. They're like, why did Daddy want to keep this? I was like, well, because Daddy really likes this game.
I'm a sucker for that game. I totally admit it. I also think that they will like that game more now if we play it again, because it's been a couple of years, and I just think
like
they were
a year
young
and change.
I think they will like that game more now.
And yeah, I agree.
I would totally play that game.
If we play it again and they're still not interested, are we still keeping the game?
I don't know.
I think if they're still not interested, it at least needs to move off the kids' shelves.
Okay, that's fair.
All right. So that was the kids' games.
It was its own effort.
That was its own separate effort. And then we started looking at everything else.
So I already mentioned one of the other strategies that I've been employing here. And we've applied this to a couple of other games that I don't think we pulled the trigger on, but I think we're probably going to, which is ultimately, we love this game. Yes, no, maybe so. But the only time we ever play this is with other people who have it.
Yeah, I'm looking at you, Flashpoint Fire Rescue.
Yeah, we have a copy of Flashpoint Fire Rescue, and it's literally still in the shrink wrap, because the only time we ever play this game is when we go over our friend Corey's house and play it with his family.
Yeah, and he's got
like every expansion.
He's got all the expansions. So everybody knows the rules. And so we just never feel the need to play it at home because we have so many other games we could play.
Right. I think that a game like Flashpoint has enough other serviceable replacements that we can scratch enough of the itch if we want to play a game like that.
I mean, we've got plenty of other cooperative games, sure.
Yeah, like, I think, you know, Pandemic does a good job, Castle Panic does a good job.
Forbidden Desert.
Yeah, I think there's enough there. And so that is a game that is probably going to hit the cull list, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's another category of games that I feel are a fairly easy decision, and that's when you have duplicates. If you have more than one copy of a game, ask yourself, why do I have more than one copy?
Right.
Is there actually a reason for this? Whether it's a straight duplicate, you just literally have multiple copies of a game, or if it's something that has been expanded upon or replaced in some way so that the older game just doesn't get played anymore. So we're getting rid of Sushi Go.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we're going to play Sushi Go, we pull out Sushi Go Party every time.
Right. There's even examples of games that have come out, and this hasn't happened to us, but there's games that have come out, and then like a deluxe edition will come out, and it's just got enough other stuff that it's worth picking that one up. That initial game
really should go away.
Gotta move on.
Yeah. Yep. Give it to somebody else who will enjoy it. As you mentioned, we're on the fence for doing this with Machikoro, mostly just because we haven't picked up one of those games that's the Machikoro killer yet.
Right. Space-based or Valeria Card Kingdoms.
Yeah, but once we have, Machikoro gets the boot.
Almost certainly.
Yeah. Other than that, really, we specifically spent a lot of time looking at our unplayed games. Games that haven't been played in the last year, sometimes more than a year. And ask ourselves, why aren't we playing this?
Right.
In my case, there are a couple of games that I love and nobody ever really wants to play with me. And it just, it's so sad. But really, I look at it and say, honestly, I don't get to have fun with this game because it doesn't have a solo mode and nobody wants to play it with me. So I'm just going to move it on. Sometimes, like one of our listeners mentioned, sometimes it's a game that everybody in the family is kind of like, meh, it's fine. If somebody asked me to play it, I'd play it. But I'm never going to ask to play it myself.
Right. One of those games for us actually was Takenoko.
Yeah. Which was surprising.
It was kind of almost a surprise to all of us to realize that we all felt that way about the game.
Yeah. So that's a great example, too, of this isn't a bad game. We all
like
enjoy it.
It's got fun art. It's lovely. It's a blast to play. It's a nice entry weight game. But nobody in the family was the one who would be the instigator of Takenoko
to
playing.
To say, hey, let's play Takenoko.
Right. It was always going to be something else. So in reality, with the few exceptions of a couple of people who knew we had it and wanted to play Takenoko at some point,
yeah,
it really never made it off the shelf in our house.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though it was... See, this is so hard because there's certain games that you almost feel like, I'm a board gamer. I need to have a copy of Catan. I need to have a copy of Pandemic. I need to have a copy of Takenoko. Right? Like,
yeah.
It's almost like expected.
Yeah.
Like, these are the merit badges that you have if you want to be considered a board gamer. And breaking out of that mold and really defining your own identity as a board gamer is actually kind of important. And it's actually really, really valuable.
Well, and it's harder if you're trying to do it for your whole family versus just for yourself. Because we definitely have very different tastes within the family and different skill levels.
Right.
So there are a lot of games where one person is like, yeah, let's play this. And everybody else is like, okay, sure.
Right. Right.
And to realize that a game like Takenoko was one where everyone in our family was like, okay, fine, means that it feels weird and hard, but it's actually an easy game to get rid of.
Right. I just want to make one more point. Going through the process of culling games is not you've checked the box saying that you've culled games and then you can move on with your life.
It's not.
It's not, unfortunately. Like for us, you know, we've gone through this process twice now where we'll go through the whole thing and we'll pull some stuff aside and we'll kind of look at it and stare at it. It's almost like looking at a picture of a tattoo to decide whether or not you want to get it. And then like a week or two later, we'll be like, all right, you know, the wound has healed. Let's go back.
Let's try again.
And do it again.
Yeah.
And do it again. Because we do still have a couple of
those maybe
stacks
games
in places, and it all needs to go on that shelf, and there really should be some breathing room.
Yes.
So we've still got some work to do, and we know that we've got some work to do. So that's just something that we're going to have to deal with. But here's the thing. We now have a stack of games to cull. What do we do with them?
That's an excellent question.
If it's Candyland, we put it in the fire pit, and we light
Burn
it on fire.
Throw it away, light it on fire, drop it in a pit somewhere.
Yeah, something like that. But in all seriousness, what can we do with these games?
Well,
what have we done with games that we were done with?
So, kids' games, as long as they're still in good shape, because that's not always the case with kids' games, as long as they're in good shape, we've donated them to our local schools, trying to match the skill level reasonably. But let me tell you, local public schools are always looking for board gamey type things that work for a 20 to 30 minute indoor recess time.
Yeah, let me say this, by the way. People have come to us and said like, oh man, you wouldn't believe I was at my kid's school and they had like all these garbage games. Well, this is your chance to fix that problem.
Yes.
Right? I get it. It's really cathartic to complain about, oh, I was at my friend's house and he had all the, oh, he thought he was so great because he had Taboo, blah. Like, this is your chance to fix that problem.
Yes, especially with schools or libraries.
Right, absolutely.
If you've noticed that your local public library has anything having to do with board games, ask them if they would accept a donation.
Mm-hmm.
Our library specifically is interested in kids' games. They're not interested in adult games. And that's fine. Like Duana said, if you donate them to the library or if you donate them to your kid's school, you can still visit them and play them once in a while.
Right.
So it's especially good for those games where maybe it's a little extra hard to let it go.
Right. One thing that we did with the first stack of games that we identified is I actually looked for ways to trade them for other games that we have been wanting to or think about picking up. I also traded some of these games for expansions to other games that we knew we loved.
Yay!
Which is great because then I can combine them all in the initial box and then we're good to go. So if you take a look on BoardGameGeek, there's a lot of opportunities on there to do some trading. There's some companies that basically act like the GameStop of board games mm-hmm. that you can look to. You're not going to get as much value out of those games as if you, you know, tried to sell them one at a time or things like that. But you're able to move a collection, you're able to move a bunch of stuff and get back one or two or three things that are exciting to you. I mean, that's still a net positive because you're creating value on your shelves and value being defined by something you're actually going to spend time with.
Yeah, and especially if you have a local board game convention, that is a great time to either sign up for a math trade.
Yeah, math trades are amazing.
Or if you've committed to say, no, I really need to reduce the number of games, not just trade games, local conventions are a great place to sell your used games.
Right.
Keep in mind, you're not going to get the same value as it is new. I feel like maybe that doesn't bear repeating, but it's a good reminder.
It is.
But remember, even if you're selling it at a loss, you're getting it to somebody else who is going to enjoy the game, and you get some benefit in the form of money.
Right. And I mean, you also have to consider games go down in price. Even new games go down in price mm-hmm. over time. Mm-hmm. So if you bought a game the day it came out for $60 and you can buy that game on Amazon now for $39.27, you're not selling that game for $40, even if it's in great shape. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
So it's important to keep in mind. One last place that you can think about donating games. If you've got a local board game cafe, they might appreciate those games.
They might.
You can always go in and ask them and see what you get.
Obviously, the last thing you can do is simply give games away to friends who would appreciate them.
Be an ambassador for the hobby board
game. Yeah. Like you mentioned, oh, you know, my friend only has Taboo, or, you know, my kids' friends only have these mass market games like Monopoly. This is a great opportunity to say, hey, I think you would really like this game. Can I play it with you? And if they do like it, say, it is yours. Keep it. And then you can spread the love. Everyone plays games. Everyone has fun. You and I have an extra way we can give away board games.
We do. And it's called a giveaway.
Yay! Podcast game giveaway!
So we said on our pod pledge, thefamilygamers.com/pod pledge, that if we hit a certain milestone, we would give away a game. And we are going to do that.
Yeah.
So we had one of our listeners very generously donated a copy of Guardian's Call. It was her Kickstarter fulfillment. And she contacted us and said, hey, would you like this game? And you can use it for whatever you want to, give away whatever.
She went through the same process we did of looking at it, sitting there in the shrink wrap and saying, I am not going to play this game.
Right. So we got this copy of Guardian's Call. I did an unboxing a couple of days ago, put that up on the Facebook page so you can see all the really great, like the miniatures in
really
this game
cool look minis.
Fantastic. And we fired up a Rafflecopter giveaway, which you can find at thefamilygamers.com. And this is great. In 3 weeks on the show, James Hudson is going to announce the winner of the giveaway.
Yay!
The man who created the game.
The man himself.
He's going to be on. He's going to talk about what's going on with Skybound and all the cool stuff he's doing with Druid City. And we're going to give away that copy of Guardian's Call. So head over to thefamilygamers.com, click on the link for that, and enter the contest.
Enter the contest! You mentioned thefamilygamers.com. Where else can you find us online?
You can find us all over the internet. You can find us on social media using the handle @FamilyGamersAA for Andrew and Anitra, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also head over to our Facebook community by going to thefamilygamers.com/community.
You can email us if you don't like that fancy social media stuff.
Andrew@thefamilygamers.com.
Anitra@thefamilygamers.com. Or there's a contact form on our website.
There is. Please don't forget to subscribe to the show, tell your friends about the show, and leave us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's so helpful.
It really does help us out quite a bit. We mentioned our pod pledge, which is where we got to that milestone to force us to give something away. You can find that, if you'd like to be part of the family, at thefamilygamers.com/pod pledge.
This episode of the Family Gamers Podcast is sponsored, once again, by Breaking Games. whether it's wagering on what popular item was invented first, or trying to catch as many stars as you can as they shoot across the sky, Order of Invention and The Stars Align from Breaking Games are two games that are perfect for the whole family. They're easy to learn, fun to play, and these games are a perfect addition to any family game night. Get them both at BreakingGames.com.
All right. Thank you so much to Breaking Games for sponsoring this episode of The Family Gamers. And I think that that's going to be it for us this week.
All right.
So until next week,
play games with your kids.